This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Sudan agrees to a temporary ceasefire in Darfur, and will he or won't he run for the White House in 08? No, we're not talking about Senator Barack Obama, but the Reverend Al Sharpton. Chiming in on these topics and more are Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Thank you all for being with us. And let's talk about this kind of surprising ceasefire in Darfur. So the president of Sudan and several rebel leaders agreed to a 60-day ceasefire in the country's war-torn Darfur region in separate meetings with New Mexico's Governor Bill Richardson. Now, Richardson is a former UN ambassador. However, the president continues to oppose a UN presence in the African country because he says non-African peacekeepers will be viewed as colonialists. What are we to make of this, Nat?
Nothing.
What do you mean by nothing?
Sorry. I mean,
you mean
I think,
nothing's
going
to come of it, or you mean
nothing's going to come of it? It is. I mean, you know, they signed a peace agreement similar to this, or I should say, let's just call this a ceasefire back in May, but it didn't take but a few days before both sides reengaged themselves in battle. This is sort of a continuing on and off again struggle between the rebels and the government. Now, of course, anytime you have the two parties decide that they're going to sign at least a cessation of violence, you have to be optimistic for that. But in fact, when you look at this from the larger standpoint, you see there's really no pressure that the UN can exert on Bashir. It's not working. The United States has virtually no role other than, of course, the personal diplomacy of the former ambassador from the Clinton administration, Bill Richardson. So what I'd say is that, unfortunately, this situation is simply one that's just going to have to work itself out until the two sides just simply get tired of killing each other.
Joe, we've heard Nat, who says basically this isn't much of anything. It really strikes me that it's unusual for someone who is a current governor, New Mexico's governor, to step into this kind of international relations capacity. He has the background, but he's not currently in a position that would kind of speak to this. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that points to the lack of involvement of the Bush administration in this conflict. It's interesting because the Bush administration was the first country in the world, I believe, to declare the situation in Darfur genocide after considerable political pressure by African activists here in Washington and around the country. But then after that, nothing happened. And in fact, Colin Powell at the time suggested that we can use the word, but then what? It doesn't really mean anything, and it turns out that seems to be the case. There's been a great deal of continuing pressure on the Bush administration in the form, certainly here in Washington, of full-page newspaper ads urging people to contact members of Congress and the White House so that the United States government would take a more active role in Sudan. But that has not happened. And I think the fact that the governor's trip was sponsored by an interest group, say the Save Darfur Coalition, indicates that, or certainly highlights the fact that you have private organizations pushing this, pushing a ceasefire more so than the government of the United States.
I guess, Professor Berry, the question is, what role does the U.S. government have in this? I mean, if there are private interest groups and there's the governor of New Mexico and there's other folks trying to get into it and make sure that people are not in a war-torn situation, what role should the U.S. be playing?
Well, the U.S. government should be playing a role, but they are distracted, I guess, at the State Department and in the White House by other matters in the Middle East and so on. But I do think that Bill Richardson, if anybody can do this, he can do it. He has had Koreans, North Koreans, come meet with him in New Mexico and at the Capitol. He has been involved with the president of Sudan and other leaders around the world since the time he was at the UN. And he's the kind of guy who can negotiate and can arbitrate. So if in the 60 days anything can happen, he can do it. But he may just be standing in the gap, hoping that by doing this And the coalition may be hoping by doing this that they can get Democrats in Congress, for example, to lean on the State Department and lean on the administration and get them to move forward or get the UN to do something. It's a hope. It's a slim hope. And I see our own government, which should be involved so that we don't have to say never again, as the Clinton administration said about Rwanda, you know, when they didn't do anything. We keep saying never again, and then things keep happening again. So maybe what Richardson is doing here is just standing in the gap and hoping that by doing this they can exert some kind of pressure on the government to do something.
Meanwhile, 200,000 people have been killed in 3 years.
Right? Yeah, and I should mention that yesterday we had a feature on the show. You can go back and hear it on NPR.org about the Lost Boys of the Sudan. And so there's been conflict in this region for decades. Want to move ahead to U.S. politics. Reverend Al, the Reverend Al Sharpton, says he is considering another run for president because he is not hearing an urban agenda. I'm going to stay with you, Professor Barry.
Please.
What do you think? I mean, you know,
What I think for Rye is run, Al, run. What I think is if I were the white candidates who are running for president on the Democratic ticket and plan to run, I would pay Brother Al to run. I would beg him to run. So that in the event that Barack Obama does run, there would be in the debates Brother Al out there attacking him from the left side and articulating the issues in such a way. The last time when the primary season took place and you had all these debates among the Democratic candidates, it was sort of like the Pips without Gladys Knight. Al was the only one that kept things lively. You know, you'd be watching, and Al would say something that made sense and wasn't afraid to say it. He has no reason, as he said himself, not to run. I mean, what is he doing that would keep him from running? So I hope that he does run. He will articulate the issues. He will liven things up. And it would be a very interesting thing to see.
But, you know, you mentioned that if the white candidates perhaps would pay him to run. If you recall, in the last election, there was allegations that basically paralleled that.
Yeah.
Right.
That he was in the race basically as a spoiler to attract attention to him and kind of suck up, you know, a lot of that political energy, particularly from the black community.
But in that case, you had Carol Moseley Braun running, but now you have potentially Senator Barack Obama running, who seems to have a little bit more of a profile. So it could be even more of a tangent. You know what I mean?
Well, I think I think that one thing I think it's clear to say about Al Sharpton, and it was also true when Jesse Jackson ran, and that is, for whatever the motivation, his candidacy or their candidacies draw attention to issues that often are ignored or largely ignored by the other candidates. I think that if Barack Obama is in the race, however, I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to be the case. Clearly, Barack Obama would not be running as a black candidate, and I'm not suggesting that Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson did, but it's certainly crystal clear that Barack Obama would not be trying to fit that role.
But
he would not be running a symbolic candidacy.
But, Joe, he is more cautious, Barack is, than
exactly.
Al, Brother Al.
That's right.
So Brother Al will make it plain because he has nothing to lose.
That's right.
And therefore, that would be an interesting dynamic.
I agree.
To see where Barack Obama would he have to lose some of his caution or what he would do. And if I were the other white candidates, I'd be very interested in seeing that take place.
All right. Well, I'm going to move you guys along and I'm going to reintroduce everybody because in case you've just joined us, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Thank God it is Friday because I have a lot of house cleaning to do. And in case you're just joining in, we're talking to Nat Ervin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, Dr. Mary Frances Berry of the University of Pennsylvania, and Joe Davidson of the Washington Post. Nat, let me go to you with the Carter Center board members' resignations. So you have 14 of 200 board members of the Carter Center resigning in protest over former President Carter's latest book. It's called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And that word apartheid got a lot of people all worked up. Now, his book argues that Israelis colonized and confiscated lands from the Palestinians. Opponents say some information is inaccurate and one-sided. President Carter once brokered peace between Israel and Egypt in 1978. Nat, what are we to make of all of this brouhaha?
Well, it was certainly a lot easier for the president when he was just building houses for Habitat for Humanity. And it was a lot easier when he was serving as a neutral observer when, you know, you'd have elections around the world. But now that he has written this book, in which, you know, you've accurately described, I think that the use of apartheid is what has caused all the furor. I have not read the book, so I want to qualify my comments by saying that. But I have been to a Palestinian refugee camp, and I've also been to South Africa. And I would say that I don't think that apartheid is the right description. After you've seen what happened in South Africa, to compare what goes on in Israel, which he says, as President Carter says, he did not intend to compare what is going on in the state of Israel with what is happening into the Palestinian refugee camps. But what the point he was trying to make is that the division of land and what the Palestinians are left with is apartheid-like situation. Now, you know, I think what he has tapped into and why this created such a lot of controversy is that America is not viewed generally as being an honest broker when it comes to Middle East politics. We are viewed as being heavily pro-Israel and less favorable toward the Arabs. And I think what has happened, unfortunately, for the president, by having used the term, the former president, by having used the term apartheid, he has subjected himself to those who want to call him anti-Semite, which I don't think there's any question that he is not an anti-Semite. He has a long history of being for the underprivileged, for the underserved, for the those who have suffered injustices. And I applaud the president, the former president, for his longstanding work on behalf of justice. I think that in this instance, he has unfortunately used a wrong term to provoke what it should be and has continued to be a long discussion about what should be the role of the United States in the Middle East politics.
So Nat is saying basically that apartheid is the wrong word, but the subject is pertinent. Joe, what do you think? I mean, a lot of this is language. You know, apartheid is a term that was heavily used in South Africa, but it could have been applied to other colonial states like Zimbabwe, where whites took over land that were occupied by blacks. What is the issue here? Is it language or is it the content of Carter's book?
Well, I think it's clearly language, but I also think it reflects, and there have been other comments, other complaints about inaccuracies within the book other than just the title. I think, though, it also reflects the larger power dynamic in the United States. I think that people who support Israel have far more power than people who support the Palestinians and Arabs generally. I think that the Israeli lobby is certainly one of the strongest on Capitol Hill, one of the strongest in this country. And I think that the reaction to the book reflects the power of those who support Israel. I mean, I think that there are plenty of people who support the Palestinians, but they don't have the political clout. Plenty of people who would agree very much with President Carter, but they don't have the political clout to make their views known either on Capitol Hill or in the literary circles, the publishing circles, or those who respond to books that come out. So I think much of this debate is a lot of it is on the accuracies or inaccuracies within the book, and that's certainly a legitimate debate. But I also think it's reflective of the power dynamic in the United States.
Well, historical inaccuracies never kept anybody from having a book that sold a whole lot and got talked about. I mean, Doris Kearns Goodwin did that, and she publicly is known to have plagiarized Stephen Ambrose, and they still write books. I mean, Ambrose is dead, but Kearns Goodwin still writes books, and they get published. Other people have been accused of things like plagiarism.
But is it right?
Which they're not accusing Carter of. They're just saying certain things are inaccurate. But I don't really think that's the issue. I think the issues are what Nat and Joe have said. But I would add this. Jimmy Carter, by anybody's measure, is a good and decent man. I know him. I worked for him when he was in the White House. And he's a reconstructed Southerner on race
Absolutely.
And bigotry questions. And has a heart beyond any. And the other thing is that I am not in favor of trying to suppress or attack books because they're provocative or they're controversial or they take positions. Books are to be published so you can argue about it. My students who spend time in Israel and who very much care about the state of Israel and these people who resigned from the thing. They care, and it's a sensitive issue for them. But my students tell me that in Israel, you could debate these questions. They're debated all over the place, and people argue right. about them, and nobody cares. Maybe it's because it's in the family. It's sort of like us calling using the N-word in the family. Maybe that's the same thing. But in any case, I think that the criticism is unfair. And I think that the issue should be debated. And on the land question in particular, as Nat says, I think it was Nat, you can make some analogies and comparisons.
Yeah.
But Carter said he wanted to be provocative and he wanted to be controversial. And he's of an age, if he can't speak his mind now and be provocative and controversial,
Absolutely.
When can he do it?
We have 1 minute left, and whoever wants to speak up can. Do African Americans have an affinity with Palestinians over a sense that there is a justice between people who have been denied some claim to land? And does that necessarily put us in an objective position or one that is blinded?
It's exactly the opposite. African-Americans,
yeah.
Because we're a people of the Bible, and a whole lot of
right.
us are religious,
right,
and a lot of us believe in the Bible literally, we think that Israel, they're the children of Israel, they're the people who are
right.
in the Bible, and we should stand with them no matter what. And most Americans and African-Americans don't really know anything about the true nature of the Palestinian question. So I think it's exactly the opposite.
And I also think historically, Mary, we look at the history of American civil rights struggle, it has been with the support of the Jewish community. So we have a long history of the two communities being together. When you're talking about global politics and the Palestinians, I think you're absolutely right. Americans and black Americans included know very little about Palestine.
All right.
I agree with most of my colleagues.
All right. We're going to leave it there. We've got Joe Davidson at the Washington Post, Nat Irvin at Winston-Salem Journal. He joined us from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And, of course, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks and good weekend to all of you.
Thank you.
And
thank
the
you.
Same to you.